This is The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Monthly and The Saturday Paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper's the source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and The Monthly is the country's best magazine of politics, culture, and ideas.
Hi, I'm Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute. Welcome to The Lucky Country. This episode, I'm going to talk to Dr. Jill Shepherd, a political scientist at the Australian National University, about the C word, class. Do you know which class you belong to? We'll find out more with Jill soon. But first, they say the only poll that matters is election day. But what rubbish! Fortnightly polls in Australia have become a fixture of modern politics. And politicians obsess about polls. No matter what they say, behind closed doors, they want to know that their party is heading in the right direction because they know that the most important thing for the country is that they retain their seat at the next election. As the polls go up, the confidence of a party goes up, and their ability, we're told, to introduce bold new ideas rises. Somehow what's good for Australia depends on how the politicians are going in the polls right now. When a prime minister's behind in the polls, either they have to consolidate support and keep their big bold ideas to themselves, or they have to try something new to shake things up to get a lift in the polls. For something that doesn't matter, opinion polls seem to keep showing up at the most important times in Australian politics. But it hasn't always been this way. Fortnightly polling is an expensive exercise, and newspapers commission it for the simple reason it helps sell newspapers. But the ability to sell newspapers is different from informing the public about what really matters in the country. Polls make for cheap news, even though they're expensive to commission. But newspapers aren't the only people that commission polls. Political parties do their own polling. National secretaries of parties and powerful people within parties have the ability to spend their party's money commissioning secret internal polling, which not only gives the party a sense of where the electorate is at, but it can also be used to test the public's interest in particular policy issues. And in turn, that secret party polling that's very tightly held by a small number of people in the party can be used to sway the minds of their own parliamentarians. When people know that the internal polling supports a particular idea, it's much easier to get that idea through the party room. And when people are told that the internal polling is looking bad, then in turn it's much harder for a particular policy idea to get up. So whether it's newspapers or whether it's the political party spending a lot of money to commission polls, we shouldn't pretend for a minute that polling doesn't play an important role in Australian politics. Now, that's not to say polling is evil. Far from it. It's a democracy. We should know what people think. But who asks the questions? Which questions are asked? How are they framed? These are issues that, for all of the talk about news poll, we don't really get much debate about in Australia. So here we are in 2018, with a country facing enormous challenges. Greenhouse gas emissions are still rising. The budget deficit's still rising. There's more than 700,000 unemployed people in the country. But what's going to get more attention in the coming weeks? Are we going to talk about Indigenous disadvantage and how, despite years of promises, the gap between Indigenous Australians and the rest of the country refuses to close? Are we going to talk about the fact that unemployment in regional Australia remains far higher than unemployment in the cities? Or are we going to talk about what yet another bad poll for Malcolm Turnbull may or may not mean? It's okay to talk about polls. It's important to understand what the community thinks about things. But polling in Australia has become an enormous distraction, a distraction from the issues we face, from the ideas that might address them, and indeed from the direction that we as a country want to go. All politicians want to go up in the polls, but that's entirely different from saying where they want to take us as a nation. The only way for politicians to form government is to convince a majority of the public to vote for them. But which majority of voters are they after? Who might vote for them? What shifts people's minds? What changes people's votes? Do they vote according to the policies proposed by each party in the lead up to the election? Or do they vote according to identity? Maybe they vote according to class. Dr. Jill Shepherd from Australian National University is a political scientist who's looked carefully at these issues for many years. Dr. Jill Shepherd, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country.
G'day, Richard.
So, Jill, you're a political scientist, and I hear you actually researched the C word in Australian politics. You're a bit of an expert in class.
I'm an expert in thinking about different ways of measuring class. What we tried to do with this work that I produced with my colleague Nick Biddle at the ANU is come up with different measures of class, right? So we think about class generally in terms of occupation. What do? Are you blue collar or are you white collar? Increasingly, that's kind of not irrelevant, but it's not a great measure, right? When we're talking about blue collar workers, we're not picking up, for instance, a whole range of people who own their own businesses. We're not picking up very low level managerial types who we would normally describe as white collar. So we use this idea that came out of France, that's been operationalized in Britain sort of about 5 years ago, that looks at three different types of capital. So you have economic capital, it's your wealth, it's your income. You have cultural capital, it's what you do. You know, do you go to the footy or do you go to opera? And then social capital, and this is, for me, the really interesting one, right? Who do you know? How occupationally prestigious are they? You know, do you hang out with doctors and lawyers, or do you hang out with tradies?
Or economists.
Or economists. We didn't even measure economists. No one wants to know who hangs out with economists. And this, to my mind, is like, that's the one we don't talk about, right? This sort of network stuff. Because it's messy, and it feels like we're judging people. And, you know, whenever this comes up, it's easy to be slapped down as saying, well, you're elitist, or, you know, why are you talking about the fact that having doctor friends would make you a better person than if you don't? And we're not talking about that at all, but we're talking about the fact that there is this stratification, right? There's something that helps some people get ahead that stops other people getting ahead in Australia. And, you know, we're trying to start a conversation, as trite as that is.
Well, before we talk about how we measure it and what your research shows, let's go back a level. Do you think class exists in Australia?
Well, it depends on what we mean by class, right?
I read the newspapers, and apparently it's class warfare to even talk about class. So,
well, exactly, right? And whenever I talk about it, I feel like I have to play up the fact that, you know, I'm just sort of from a really working class family, and my dad's a mechanic, and my mum, you know, both my parents dropped out of school at 14. You have to sort of harness yourself, right, against these accusations that we are ivory tower elites who sit back and throw bombs about, you know, trying to start class warfare. You can't say anything without it being slapped down, you know, as a class warfare mechanism or something, right? So this is why, you know, and as academics, this is what we do, right? We try to stick so closely to the science of it, or, you know, the empirics of it. So I'm really pushing this line that we're just interested in the measurement. Of course there's class. Of course there's absolutely class. When I did year 12 at my public high school in the outskirts of Melbourne, My careers counsellor said, oh, you know, you're doing all right at school, but you might want to consider TAFE. You know, if I'd been at a private school, you'd never get that. And the way I've described it, the way I'm increasingly thinking about it is that it's about worldview. It's about the opportunities that you know are out there. And if your social networks are diverse and elite, then you know that all these things are possible.
So what's driving the class divide in Australia? Is it where we live? Is it where we went to school? Is it how much we earn? Or is it that our parents taught us to, I don't know, care about opera and not go to the rugby. Well, rugby league, I should say, because obviously sport, you know, there's distinctions there.
Right, absolutely. Do you want the really dull answer?
I don't know. How dull is it?
It's a bit of everything, right? We can't pinpoint it. Oh, I'd love to say that it's about going to public school or private school.
I want a silver bullet here.
And I don't know how you fix it. And I don't think that you do need to fix it even, but you just need to be aware of it. That is what it is. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But I think if we can talk about it reasonably, and maybe this is just the way my mind works, but if we can think about it as being comprised of these different things and there is no silver bullet, then maybe we can get our head around it a little bit better. But that's not going to work, is it? Like, politically, you need a silver bullet.
Well, maybe, maybe not. I actually think democracies do well when people have honest conversations about things. Why are so many people working so hard to prevent an honest conversation about the fact that some people leave school not just with more opportunities, but with more awareness and more support than others? Why would people want to silence that conversation?
Because, well, that's not a rhetorical question, right? There are legitimate answers to that. Politicians don't particularly want us to think too hard about things. Now, that sounds really grim, right? And really pessimistic. But there are incentives at work here. The politicians want us to, as much as possible, keep making political decisions, electoral decisions, you know, who do we vote for, on the basis of as little information as possible. Because then we don't move around so much. Then we're stable. They know the voters to target. They know who is going to vote for them regularly. They know who might be inclined to swing. If we start thinking too carefully about things and having sort of more nuanced conversations, taking a broader set of factors into consideration when we cast our vote, then that opens up a can of worms that, you know, politically we're not, politically our parties and candidates aren't really equipped to deal with.
So my former political strategist role makes me want to argue with you about that, because wasn't John Howard's genius that he went to working class Labor voters in Western Sydney and said, you should vote for the Conservative Party that wants to cut taxes because we'll be much tougher on immigrants than the Labor Party.
Okay, so that's, okay, I think some of the Howard mythology is a bit apocryphal, right? We look back now and we say, oh, Howard, you know, really swung Western Sydney, for instance. He may have. I mean, the demographics were changing pretty closely at that time as well. What we know about immigration as a political issue is that it cross-cuts party lines. There will always be Labor voters who are concerned about immigration, the very sort of diplomatic way of putting it. There will always be Liberal voters who are concerned about immigration. But on the same side, you will have Labor voters and Liberal voters who are more open borders, right? Who are more laissez-faire about who comes in and how we embrace a multicultural society. Immigration's an odd one. There aren't many issues that do cross-cut those party allegiances in the way that immigration does. I think with Howard, look, increasingly my view on Howard, and I've just written a book on the 96 election, which was nice. It helped, it really made me clarify my thinking on this.
And you mean you learned something writing a book in your ivory tower?
I did.
Oh, man.
Well, I learned something. I don't
How's
know.
How's that going to help the community?
It's not. That probably won't. Let's not lie. But what increasingly what I think about that switch from Keating to Howard is that we went from someone in Keating who did try to have nuanced conversations. He did try to sell us on social progressivism in ways that are hard to digest, they're hard to get your head around. And I really do give voters a fair bit of credit, right? I give voters a lot more credit than I give political elites. I think Howard, though, capitalised on that by really, and this is such political jargon, right, but by really instituting this small target campaign. If you look at the 96 election, he played, like, he really ran dead. You know, he didn't talk too much about doing anything particularly.
Well, he was relaxed and comfortable.
He was relaxed and comfortable. And I've tried to explain Howard to friends overseas and colleagues, and that sums it up. Relaxed and comfortable is the most, I mean, it describes his whole prime ministership, in my view, and it is the most easy heuristic, or, you know, to use the jargon, but shortcut. What kind of society do you want? Do you want Keating's scary, new, bold future? We're only starting to talk about the issues that Keating was talking about in the early 90s now, in any sensible way. It's 25 years later. He was so far ahead of his time. And Howard absolutely capitalised on that. That's so symbolic of, I think, the point I'm trying to make is that they want us thinking about simple, clear instructions when we go to vote. Nuanced conversations about class do not fit into that schema at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, wasn't one of John Howard's greatest tricks that his opponents kept accusing him of having no vision and being stuck in the 1950s behind a white picket fence, which for a lot of voters went, oh, cool.
That's exactly.
That sounds nice. Sign me up.
You bang on, right? And this is what progressives, and I guess, identify as a progressive in that I don't want to go backwards. We never got that about Howard, right? We never understood that actually people love that. We are incredibly small C conservative as a nation. We are slow to catch up with the rest of the world. And we can embrace that. We can say, great, it's our stability. And it's probably behind a lot of our economic growth. You know, when we look around other countries, maybe it's a good thing that we are trepidatious. We are cautious about reform. On the other hand, you know, when things change, we could be stuffed.
Look, back to that. I'm an admirer of John Howard. Not only was he a successful prime minister in terms of duration, he was a successful prime minister in his own terms. He delivered enormous amounts of his reform agenda. But of course, I would argue that one of his keys to his success was to deny that he had such an agenda. No, I'm stuck in the past. Yeah, look at my tracksuit. Oh, how about those wallabies? Look at that. I walk every morning or I'd get a little chubby. You know, he's out there depicting himself as this relaxed and comfortable, boring politician
yep.
who had a radical transformative agenda for privatisation of health, education, immigration. He killed the Republic movement. You know, he's the one, the whole same-sex marriage debate came about because, of course, he's the one that made it illegal. But he did all of that while being accused by his opponents of having no vision, no plan, and not standing for anything. Yet, we still hear politicians say today that the only way to get elected is to have a bold plan.
Yeah.
John Howard got elected not only by denying he had one, he spent 10 of his 12 years denying he had one implementing it.
Who's been elected recently with a bold plan?
Well, indeed. Well, you're the political scientist.
Oh, no one, right? And look at Turnbull. I'd say Turnbull's trying to do the same thing. It's like he's been reading books on Howard's prime ministership. Turnbull has...
Except the winning bit.
Hey, he's doing it so far. Turnbull has... He's got stated aims, right? He's got a stated plan. And when was the last time you heard him talk about having any kind of vision? I was trying to explain to my students the other day the concept of headland speeches. You know, politicians used to get up and promote a plan or a vision. And now why would anyone do it? You would be slapped back in your box.
By your own backbench.
Yep. Yes, exactly, right? By your backbench first and then by your opposition. Why would you wedge yourself like that, you know?
So coming back to class, do different kinds of voters respond to different kinds of leadership? Is there a constituency out there for a bold vision? Is there a constituency out there for a return to the past? And if so, given it's a democracy, which one's bigger?
So we've looked into it a little bit. The data that we have aren't great, but you do see kind of tracks pretty much how you would expect. Classes that appear to us, and we've only looked at this at one snapshot in time, so we can't really make claims about trends, but classes that appear to be moving from a lower class into a higher class, right? So they're exceeding the success, I guess, if we want to use the really crude term, you know, that you're higher, the higher the class, the more successful you are. But they're outstripping their parents. They are voting more progressively. They prefer Labor and the Greens over the Liberals. The classes who are more sort of stuck, I guess, who are more static, tend to prefer the Liberal Party. And then you have sort of Greens voters who really don't know where to put themselves, who straddle a lot of these different classes. And that'll be really interesting, I think. We haven't looked much at Greens voters in Australia because they've been a small group. And also they haven't been a core group. What you've had with regards to Greens voters, you know, in the last 20 years, is a sort of shifting beast. You might get people who split their ticket, so who will vote Labor in the lower house and Greens in the upper house, who wouldn't necessarily describe themselves as Green voters. As the Greens start running more and more in the lower house and are this sort of potential second force, say Batman or Sydney, you do see this sort of strengthening core. They're going to be really interesting as we get more data on them. We just don't know much about them yet. But in terms of class, they're all over the shop.
And one last question. Why do people vote for One Nation?
Richard. Lots of reasons. A lot of it is people don't want to change how things are at the moment. We have this idea in psychology that we've poached mercilessly and used in political science that talks about social dominance orientation. People who like the idea of stratification and ordering, right, in any society. And at the moment, they're people who are on top. It depends on how we, you know, cut the pie, but they're people who've benefited from Australian society and the way that it is structured. I hate to yield to stereotype, but actually I don't. I love invoking stereotypes because usually they make sense. But it is white guys. right, is middle-aged white guys who've benefited from the current social order. They don't want change. And if you don't want change, like One Nation are your people, right? and it's a real thing. So, and I think that they're fearing change. They're fearing, you know, even Turnbull's a bit sort of, you know, he's a bit shaky. He doesn't really hate gays enough, you know, or he might be a little bit wishy-washy on immigration levels. If you are benefiting from the current structure of society and you see that things, or people keep telling you that things should change, or you see that things might change, then absolutely you retreat to the most reactionary option. It's totally rational.
So on the one hand, we've got people saying the only way for Australia to prosper is to have a big, bold reform agenda, which is by definition change. But at the same time, there's a growing constituency for people that just want things to stay the same.
Yep, absolutely.
How's that going to play out?
And not well. And I think the coalition's got the biggest problem here, because they have traditionally appealed to voters who do want to get ahead, who do want to become self-made, you know, who independent contractors. This is sort of the late 90s, early 2000s kind of hallmark, right?
Boys in bobcats.
Of the coalition's appeal. But they might not win under change. They might not win under automation. They might not win under globalization. And they're the voters who will probably look elsewhere. Now, what does that mean for coalition strategy? I don't know. But we are at a bit of a shifting point, I think, in terms of how we think about a lot of things. And we will see. We want to rerun this class analysis repeatedly over the next 10 to 20 years, because this is going to change. This is going to be really dynamic, and I don't know how it's going to end.
So thank you for coming out of your ivory tower to tell us about these things. Here at The Lucky Country, we very much appreciate it, and we're lucky to have you.
Thanks, Richard.
So it's widely believed that Australia is the land of the fair go. But how does this work within a class system? The Lucky Country's conducted its own polling with producer Jolene Laverty, who put class to the pub test.
Do you think class exists in Australia?
Well, yes, of course it does.
What sort of classes do you think there are?
Well, there's an underclass, what Marx would have referred to as the lumpen proletariat. There's a diminishing working class. There's a, and this is just very broad categories, a slightly more substantial middle class, which is under pressure, but safeguarded by various Australian institutions, unlike their American counterparts, and an upper middle class, and a stratospheric class consisting of billionaires.
Do you have a sense of which class you might belong to?
Firmly in the middle class.
Is there movement between classes, do you think, in Australia?
Well, not as much as there was a couple of decades where there was, there appeared to be movement when education was opened up to everyone. Reflect back, and I'm old enough to reflect back to the Whitlam era and free education. And the movement of bright working class kids into the major universities in Australia and thereon into the professions, the bureaucracy, the military.
What do you think needs to happen in Australia to make sure there's a little bit more mobility?
Well, the key to it is education and providing access to education the proper funding of public education. That is the key. There has to be.
Do you believe we have a class system in Australia?
Oh, yes, I do. I mean, I came from France originally, and I came over here for many reasons. But one of the reasons was that I had the feeling that Australia was a kind of a fair country where I think everybody had opportunities. I think the opportunities are still there, but they are certainly not as widespread, I would say, as probably 20 or 30 years ago. Education and the price of it. So, you know, I come from a country where education is free, and it should be free, or at least it should be accessible to everyone. This, for me, is a problem in Australia, and it's a global problem in any event.
Do you think class exists in Australia?
I think so. Some people don't, but I think so.
You said you were talking about it in the car the other day.
Yes, well, I was sort of talking about neighbours, and I find some people are not our standard of of people, the way we live. They have like different ideas, and which I would normally class as a bit lower class. Yeah. Not that I feel that I'm high, upper class or whatever. It's just that they do things much differently than what we do.
And you think that can be attributed to a class system?
Well, I think it's a lot to do with income. You think so? Yes, yeah. I think it's got to do with income. Yes, yeah. Not that we have money, but what I'm trying to say, expectations and that. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Sorry, I have found that there are the upper class here that are quite snobbish. That I find, yes, and you can't sort of get into their circle because they although they're very polite, they sort of prefer their own class.
So you've got experience of that yourself?
Yes.
Would you want to move in those circles?
No, I would just like everybody to get along and appreciate each other and respect each other for what they are and who they are. Mm. So saying that, I can't say that I'm better than our neighbours, but you would like them to have just a better standard of just language for one thing. Yes.
So it sounds like there's a raft of different things going on there.
Yes.
What about you? Do you think that there's a class system in Australia?
Yes, I do. I'm from Canada originally, and I see it more here. With the private school thing, when I went to school, everybody went together. There were very few. There were Christian schools, but not elite Christian schools and that sort of thing. I mean, I went to school with the doctor's kids, the lawyer's kids, the garbage collector's kids. So it was different.
So there you have it, Richard, the Lucky Country pub test. And the people that I surveyed, they all agreed that class does in fact exist. Not that it's necessarily a problem, but it would be better if people had more mobility, and that mobility comes through education. And the views there were that a free education is the best way to make sure that more people can enjoy the benefits that come with being in the next class up.
Well, thanks, Jolene, and thank you for joining us here on the Lucky Country. And we hope you can join us again next week. This podcast is brought to you by Schwartz Media, publisher of the Saturday Paper and the Monthly, and Future Super, Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund.